far away from my friend and relation, betrayed by the black velvet band.
Hello and welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Alex.
And today we've got a very exciting, interesting episode for you, because today we're going to be delving into the world of Victorian murders. But before I begin, I just want to, and I echo the same sentiment that Alex has, that we're not doing this so much as to be sensationalist or, you know, make light of these events. We're doing it because we believe that they are important historical events, and that by looking at the phenomenon of murder in the Victorian period and other periods of history as well, we can understand and shine a light into factors of, you know, socioeconomic factors and the daily lives of a lot of people. So, yeah, and I think it's a really important thing to discuss and an important thing to explore, and I know that Alex feels the same. So that's what we're going to be looking at today. Is there anything you'd like to add, Alex, about what's in store during this episode?
Well, I've got to say, when you suggested this, I was over the moon. So Amy and I, obviously, we always kind of iron out our ideas, and we were sort of looking at doing kind of Victoriana, a run of kind of three episodes, and then Amy was really keen to do murder, to discuss it, obviously.
Yeah, not literally.
As opposed to conversations. Well, time will tell. but I was like, yeah, I just thought that's such a good idea, fully on board. And also, I thought what was really interesting was the kind of dynamic of Amy, you telling us a story, but also then like you and I on the periphery kind of discussing what contributes to that, to the kind of salacious side. And also, I'm going to talk a little bit about the police and various things like that. So what kind of gave way to this Victorian, I suppose, hysteria, really, to do with crime that I'm going to argue is rife today? Because like the Victorians, we are still absolutely fascinated by true crime. I mean, I think sex scandals, certainly more so probably in the early noughties, 90s, things like that. But that's hugely given way to, I would say, a new generational obsession with true crime. So
definitely, yeah.
And I think the Victorians, I mean, I'm not going to go into it because you're going to kind of take us on this road to start with, but the Victorians are synonymous with all that sort of thing. And I think, to me as well, like, you and I both are the medieval era, but we're both massive Victorian fans, and look, it's got to be one of my favorite periods of history. I'm obsessed with the Victorians, so this is despite being a macabre subject, an absolute joy. I also want to give a shout out to, so, and we might, although I'm kind of landing the same because I haven't actually mentioned it yet, but we do get some, well, we've got a lot of very loyal listeners who are giving us mentions and shout outs and things like this. And I want to start by giving Maggie Challoner a shout out, who is a regular listener and is a history fan and all the rest of it, and has been listening from the start. And although I believe from talking to her the other day is playing catch up on these, I think we should kind of try and do some listener shout out. So this one's for Maggie, because I know I told her we're going to be discussing murder and she was excited. So hopefully you catch this one, Maggie, and this episode, however bad taste, dedicating the murder one is to you. I also want to very quickly say, if Angel doesn't mind, it's just that we have our first, although we're probably going to do one beforehand, but we've got our live booking, which is down in Tanners in Shrewsbury, which is the Shropshire Witches live, just before Halloween, 2 days before Halloween, and it'd been up for 3 days and it's already sold out. So we're really, really excited. So we are looking at taking this on the road, aren't we, Amy?
Yes, and there's lots of developments and discussions and secret handshakes.
Very Masonic.
Very Masonic. going on in the background. But if you have anywhere that you think would be good, that would have us, that we'd fit in, please drop us a message, because we want to get out. We've got 6 weeks with me being a teacher to explore and, you know, get out there and put the Shropshire Witches on the road. So if you can think of anywhere, please let us know, because it would be great to meet people and share our stories in a different format.
I've got to say as well, and Amy will agree with this, that we're both very pro community, so don't think you have to be some sort of souped up sexy venue. I hate that word, sexy. I don't know why I said that, but you know, like, we are very pro the kind of the village halls, the WIs, all these things, because to us, you know, we're both kind of complete Shropshire lasses, but this kind of heart of community and villages and things like that, I think, is so essential and so key with storytelling. So if you've got things like a WI or anything like that, just approach us and ask us, because we're well into doing stuff that's for the community as well. Yeah. I think that's a really key thing. So don't think that we're kind of after like big bucks, fancy venue, that.
Yeah.
Not at all. We're kind of celebrating folklore history and keeping these old stories going, as kind of saccharine as that sounds. It's true. So I would love, and Amy would as well, to go out to like Clan or wherever, like some funny, gorgeous, quirky, eccentric towns and talk about, you know, folklore, which is so rife in all these areas. So tap us up. That doesn't mean sex, does it? No, that's tap means like contact, doesn't it?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Is tap that? Tap that.
We're showing our age here, aren't we?
And a few Gen Z listeners have just died. Yes. There's no way with my accent I get away with tap dat. Tap dat now. good. Sounds like some sort of Morse code or something from Bletchley. Tap dat. You hear that, Roger? Tap dat. Anyway, right, before we digress further, do you want to take us into the belly of crime that is Victorian London, Shropshire and elsewhere?
Yeah, definitely. So,
over to you.
Can you imagine if I just said no then? Like, no, I don't.
No, do you mind if you don't? Stop recording.
No, so before we begin, I want to just kind of really get your thoughts on this, because when I was thinking about murder, again, not me doing one, the historical,
how would I get away with it?
Murder. Yeah, I wouldn't. I'm useless at that.
I'm too indiscreet. Yeah.
Wouldn't work. When I was thinking about murder, I was thinking, why is it that we think of the Victorian times when we hear that word? Why is it that when, you know, when I went to university, I studied history, I was a medievalist. Yeah. I know that there were some bloody awful medieval murders, and there's some great resources, like there's a murder map that you can go on online, and it tells you where different murders happened in the medieval period for like York, London, and I think it might be, I can't remember, it's one of another city. So I know that there was murders throughout our history.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is the Victorian time that we associate so much with this most grave crime?
I think it's convoluted, and I think that's such a solid question. I think the press, but I know that you're going to take us on a kind of more of a whistle stop tour of the press. I think that's a huge part of it. I think the railways, because getting things around, getting news around, getting all sorts around became far easier. I think it was the age of invention, the age of science. I think the way we looked at this sort of thing changed. I think the laws around death penalties and things changed, and so we became maybe more sanitized, perhaps. I think it was also the age, in inverted commas, of reform, of literacy, of all these things. So I think there was a general awareness around good and bad. And I think there was, although still a non-secular age, I think we slightly stepped away from things of liturgical kind of, you know, and more towards science. And so we started to look more at the crimes than just crimes against God, as they'd been in previous years. And going into the 19th century, when they got rid of public executions and things were done behind closed walls, that immediately starts to bring curiosity what goes on. And of course, prisons, you know, I know we're going to go into this more, but the second you've got prisons more in the format that we would know of them, you start to wonder what goes inside, on inside. You know, so I think there's a whole combination of things that happened over a span of probably 80 to 100 years. And also because, you know, it's like this sort of faux myth, this idea that Victorians were so opposed to sex, when actually they were hypersexualized with the general's relish and the rest. And, you know, they were obsessed. And it's the same with true crime. But I think, look, the Victorians, a bit like the Tudors with their propaganda and things like this, because they were kind of slightly precarious on the throne. I think the Victorians, they'd got, I was going to say their first, well, not the first, but like after Hanoverian rule, they'd got a kind of English queen who wasn't really sort of strictly English anyway. These are not my views. But this is, so they got this new age. She was young. It was considered, you know, with Prince Albert being kind of science mad. Like I say, it's the age of invention. It was an enlightened age as they saw it. So I think their attitudes towards crime changed, and people started to find crime fascinating in a way that they had in bits and bobs. But I do think that step back from a religious view of it more to a scientific must have had a huge effect. Social reform, things like this, social acts, workhouses, prisons, all these things, you know, and maybe starting to dip your toe into the water of, like, you know, alienists and things, which would now be psychologists, looking at more of the idea of why people do things they do. And of course, mass poverty, the rookeries, all this kind of thing? So it's a great question. It's a huge thing to answer, but a whole combination of things. God, I could just talk about just that all night.
Yeah, but same. Yeah. And I think that's going to be the hardest bit about this episode, is that not just talking about the circumstances that led to that. I think it was Marie-Anne Kilday that referred to it as the cult of the criminal in Victorian England, is that idea that criminality became so fascinating, it almost became cult-like in itself. And I think so much of it is linked to circumstance. You've got, as you said, the growth of newspapers. So really our story, I think, begins slightly prior to the Victorian times. Mm. And as with everything in history, the influence of one century bleeds into the next. But you've got things like murder ballads.
Yeah.
Murder ballads were, you know, really, really scratched that itch of morbidity and allowed people to explore the most gruesome crimes imaginable. And there are several murder ballads that were based on Shropshire-based murders stories like even as early as the 1600s, Enoch Ap Evan, who axed his mother and brother to death in the
1600s,
as you do, that's down the way. And he did that over differences in religion, because it was all to do with how you prayed the mass, I think, or something like that. So certainly that was there beforehand, and you had murder ballads being shared into the 1700s, but there wasn't that real growth in printing. There wasn't that real growth in distribution of newspapers until you get to the Victorian period, where it became a lot easier to print things, to develop things, and actually to share these stories. And as a result of that, you saw in this kind of the growth of the newspaper industry, a lot of the newspapers being less than honest a lot of the times. Yeah. They nothing's changed, has it really? They saw how easy it was if you included all the most gory details and the worst details of a murder to how it would fly off the shelves.
Yeah.
So they often focused on sensationalism and even embellishment. There are newspaper accounts that are clearly embellishment of the case that they're reporting, because that interest was there. Mm. I think it was really interesting as well when you said about the public executions going indoors. So prior to kind of them being moved into the prisons, if you had that desire for morbidity, you could literally go and watch someone die, which is still, you know, years I've studied and loved history, I still can't believe that used to be a thing, that you could go and watch somebody die.
It's sad, but you think about going to even things like the Babington plot, where like the old story goes, doesn't it? The screams were so bad at the first lot, that I shouldn't say a lot, the first people killed, that the second she said clemency, like to be a swifter execution. But and I suppose that's it. In the 19th century, slightly sanitized in the way that idea of hang, drawn and quartering was starting to appall them. And of course, the 1932 Act, that sort of there were less things that you could be hanged for, as opposed to sort of George. Well, that still is George,
England,
obviously, until 1837. But yeah, but they were like, walk past the sheep, right, there you go. It's the lot.
Did you just breathe in the presence of the Lord?
What? Why? String him up. It's and obviously, again, like, you know, methods of execution change and things like that. But yeah, no, it's fascinating, isn't it? I always think that appetite for blood. But then, to be honest, we get it now.
Yeah,
watching films and Game of Thrones and things that often I think, oof, God, it's a bit much. I mean, I can watch some pajamas and things. But some stuff people can watch and not flinch. You know, wonder. I suppose we're separated by the screen, so it doesn't feel like reality, but some of the things look pretty real and people can really stomach it. So I think human aptitude for violence, for blood, things like that, never goes away. It's just not on our streets in the way that it once was, but we still watch it on television, which, you know, and it looks very realistic. So, you know, you could argue it's still there. It's just that we justify it by saying that's an actor and he'll be picking up, you know, an Oscar or something.
Yeah, I agree there. And I think that really leads nicely into the idea of the penny dreadfuls, because
I love the penny dreadfuls. Go on,
you've
talk
got
about
the
them.
Growth of literacy, still not in the same way that we have today, because there was still, you know, I only have to look at marriage records in my family to see the amount of crosses that were signed. That not everyone could read, not everyone could write, but there was more people who could read. And you know, even if there was one person in the household that could read, that meant that everybody in that household had access to those stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, I whenever I think of Penny Dreadfuls, it's not strictly a Penny Dreadful, but I always think about Sweeney Todd.
Yes.
And when I was a child, big shout out to my dad, Big Steve here. I was a child, so I was probably about 8 or 9, my dad told me with absolute utmost conviction that Jack the Ripper was bad, but Sweeney Todd was worse. And that Sweeney Todd was a real murderer and that he actually did make people into pies, and that the whole plot of the Sweeney Todd musical was actually real. So I was absolutely mortified and horrified, because, you know, cannibalism is quite scary to an 8-year-old.
You're vegan, by the way.
There's lots of reasons. wouldn't trust a pie.
It's one of them. It's one of them.
So, you know, I was terrified. So I goes into school.
Don't you worry, old lad.
I told my teacher, and I almost told her a bit like I was like, you know, whispering, telling her a bit of unheard knowledge.
Oh,
and she told me that it wasn't the case. Oh. And then the whole class laughed at me. So thanks,
Dad. I don't want to hear that. Makes me really sad, because that's, I know it's patronizing, but that sounds really cute.
So Sweeney Todd, though he isn't real, and though a lot of the things that were in the Penny Dreadfuls were not real, they tapped into that sensationalism that the newspapers were putting forward.
Yeah.
And I think if you're reading something that's absolutely brutal in the newspapers that you know actually happened, and then you're reading a story, it's very easy for those two stories to merge, and the Penny Dreadfuls become the newspapers, and then the newspapers take influence from these stories. And then before you know it, you've got almost these really, really infamous murders entering folklore in themselves. And I think a perfect case of that is the Jack the Ripper murders, is that less focus was traditionally put on the plight of the women, and that's why books like The Five are so great, where it actually unpacked and showed who the women were. And the more emphasis was on this kind of quasi-folkloric Spring-Heeled Jack type character that went around London murdering women. And I think the way that the Victorians saw murder made the murders that were really infamous enter into a space that is very similar to folklore.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think, to be honest, like with like maybe the era before. So, and again, so I said, I know 1832 with this kind of act, and that's still technically the Georgian era, of course, but they were more kind of going into, you know, your highwaymen and things like this, and these kind of characters that kind of became folkloric, but also were like, sort of almost like not celebrate, well, yeah, celebrated in a roundabout way, like Dick Turpin, things like this, and doing feats that aren't actually humanly possible or equine possible with poor old Black Bess. But I think you go into the Victorian age, and that there seems to be more of a hankering for blood in a way.
Yeah.
I suppose, because it's getting sanitized off the streets in a way in terms of execution. But like Jack the Ripper, this fixation, of course, condemning, like, you know, coming down on the women, saying they're sex workers, they're X, Y, and Z, bang tails and all these things that they used to call them. But I think, you know, you can't step away from the fact that things like the police coming in made a difference. And the courts, of course. So you've got, when it comes to a court, so, for example, when you have court sessions, so you would have court sessions that would happen more frequently than you would have assizes, and we still do. So assizes would happen about twice a year. And then in some places like Northumberland, more remote, it'd be sort of once a year. But these places, everybody would go through this, that were kind of not like Crown Court stuff, but still pretty high up. They would put their case to a trial. No women were allowed on the jury till after one counsel priest, obviously, because, you know, the last thing you need is someone with a vagina on them making a decision.
Our wombs would make us, you know, because our wombs float around our bodies. They would make us not make a good decision. So,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I understand that.
I agree with that, because I think every world leader that's causing problems presently is a man.
you know, floating
there we go. Anyway, you know, so I think this kind of idea of, you know, like you had, so 1748, you had the Bow Street Runners. And this kind of, even their name's quite flamboyant, it's quite extra, isn't it? It's kind of like,
yeah,
it's a bit diva. They're like, oh, that's the Bow Street Runners, babe. Don't worry about
they
it.
They sound like they would be dressed like 1960s Beatles. You know, when the Beatles came back from India?
Yes.
That's what, yeah, I see. And I
with
know
their
they're
cultural
not.
Appropriation.
Yeah, but that's what like, the image I
but
get
it's
from the Bow
okay because
Street
it's
Runners.
John Lennon. Yeah. I totally, totally agree. And it was a little bit like, you know, when you had like you're definitely of this era as well, but you know, like the Strokes, the Killers, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's giving that, isn't it? Of like the kind of mid early 2000s as well.
Bonkers. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Razorlight, all the rest of it. You had the Thames, the Thames River Police. Love that in 1798. I mean, these guys say what you see.
Yeah. Yeah. We are on the Thames.
All there. We're on the Thames and we are the Thames River Police. And then you had in 1829, because obviously Sir Robert Peel was Foreign Secretary at that point, later on to be PM. But he set up the Metropolitan Police and we got the Bobbies or the Peelers. So hence, for anyone that doesn't know that, I'm sure you all do, but Bobbies are called Bobbies because of Robert Peel. So things like this started to change. The way we were looking at crime started to change. You had Scotland Yard, the Met's first headquarters at Whitehall, all these things that started to accumulate. It wasn't till later in the century that you got detectives. The bit I always find about the detectives, and hold on to your sort of Nigel Farage hats here, but in true British style, because we love to be tossers like this. I'm sorry, but we do. The detectives had existed in France for some time and it came over here and we're like, nah, 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 nah. I don't think so. I think we're fine not knowing in 1888 with Jack the Ripper, because this is relevant, whether it's animal blood or human blood. So you couldn't identify blood types, blood groups, of course, nor could you identify it was animal or human blood at that point. Excellent. So when they started to bring in detectives, and they have by that point, because famously you've got Aveline, haven't you? So Frederick Aveline,
yeah.
Ripper. But when that sort of thing started, they were like, no, 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 no. Very French, and we don't want that here.
We don't want any of that here.
We don't want solutions to crime. Okay? Thank you very much. So the
bring
Robert
it back to thing, you and crime.
Bring it back as it was. We're fine. It's a very British thing. So they started to look at preventing crime rather than just punishing people, which I think they felt belonged in previous centuries. So that's another thing that changed, of course, is that they were looking at preventing crime, prevention, not cure, much as people try to do Botox now, or baby Botox, just freaked me out. I know that's from another episode or one we've already talked about. But I do think this idea is really interesting. And I did find it funny that the idea of bringing a detective over, which is to us very, like a very evident, you know, thing to do. They were like, no, no, no. That yeah, belongs to the continent. Yeah, don't be. We've got Robert Peel. The last thing we need is a bloody Frenchman telling us how to solve crime. Okay. And I just thought, God, British then, British now. The other thing that I find just marvelous, of course, about the Met is that their their first uniform, they wore top hats because, you know, divas. They were also given a truncheon, oi, oi, and a rattle, later replaced with a whistle. So if I were going into the rookeries of London, I would definitely, definitely want to be wearing a top hat, take a truncheon, yeah, a rattle to encounter your Bill Sykes-esque characters. I say, old chap, I see what you're doing to that woman. You're brutalising her. Well, watch out. Doffs his cap and gets his rattle out. You appreciate the gesture. The idea was a sense of security that they had. Obviously, people felt secured compared to sort of parish watchmen and things like this. And Bobby on the beat, they would have two policemen for quite a small area. So, in fact, so much so in London that the Bobby would be seen twice in 15 minutes. In some areas, and you're like, oh, good luck with that today. It's not their fault. It's the government cuts. I'm not going to go into that anyway. But, you know, Tory tenure, here we go. But their high collars contained a leather band that protected them from garroting and from attacks and things like this. And they would walk around the neighbourhood at a relatively slow pace, twice in 15 minutes, hoping to prevent crime basically before it happened. In 1842, the Met Detective Department was set up to give a force a better chance of solving crime. But like I say, it was met with some resistance in being sort of silly French nonsense. And 1888, I mean, what's that sort of 40 years? They had Jack the Ripper, which was kind of pictured in Punch magazine, Penny Dreadful, things like this. If something's been in place for sort of around 40 years, that's quite a learning curve, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they did in the 1880s have police matrons who were hired to supervise women and children in police stations and courts. And yeah, it's cool, isn't it? And during the First War, they had two groups of volunteers formed, which are Women's Police Service, the WPS, and the Voluntary Women's Patrols.
Oh,
that's going into a different sanctuary. But I do love that they could have the bobbies and things, and they had the women instead were police matrons.
That's amazing.
Kind of get the logic, but there you go. So yeah, sorry, you carry on.
No, I was just going to say, I was just thinking when you said about the rattles, and obviously I knew about, but I'd never really thought about it before. If you're some hardened criminal and, you know, you're going about your crime, I don't know, with a big bag of loot on your back or something.
Yeah.
And you see some like twat in a top hat rattling a rattle at you.
You're like, oh, here he comes.
Are you, it's actually like
Boris Johnson, isn't it? Coming? You're like, oh, fucking hell. Yeah.
You're just going to burst out laughing.
Yeah.
Like, you what, mate? Like, it's just...
Oh, yeah. These guys are like Newgate.
Yeah.
They're not, like, we're not talking kind of, all right, governor, doff your cap, nip a little something out of your pocket, are we? We're talking hardened crims living in rookeries who've grown up and knowing poverty and cruelty and things. You know. Yeah, I don't think some guy wielding a... You know, a kind of what we would now think was like a kind of like 1950s football rattle is, yeah. I mean, I don't think we're talking christening rattle, but I think we're in the terms of like a wooden, Oh, watch out, lads. No, I think there's going to be, and he's like, oh, I think you can hurt me. Can you? My collar's got a leather, so you can't cut me. It's like, mate, I'll just stab you in the kidneys instead. These guys are like, yeah, they're, I mean, they're in and out of prison. We can talk more about, kind of a little bit about the prisons in a bit of time, but I didn't think I was going to touch the sides of criminals like that.
Oh, you've got your rattle. I'm sorry, sir, I will stop crime.
Yes, what? I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. Kind of the East End of London, like petrifying, and he's like with his top hat. You're like, oh, watch out, guys, he's not coming to Bent Lawn, do you know what I mean? No. To rest.
Well, it is interesting because there were, so when you talk about like the rookeries and things, there were areas in Shropshire that had that same kind of reputation.
Stop it.
So really? for instance,
I've got to say, I'm only stepping in. I know this is going to be like, no, because she's saying something interesting. I just want to wait it because I have a thing, okay? It's call it a peccadillo, call it a quirk, call it a perversion, call it what you will. I love to read the parish newsletter, okay, which in itself is fun, but I love to read the crime stats. Guys, I live in an unidentified village. I won't say where, in South Shropshire. Amy knows where, she's been here. But you can imagine, Amy, the crime rate in this village is pretty low, actually.
Man steals book.
Yeah, man cut hedge. It's that. Woman walked down field with dog behind her, dog did poo, she missed it, didn't pick it up. Landowner's like, you didn't pick up the poo. This is what you're dealing with, okay?
Yeah.
And I love to read it. And they go a little bit further to some of the villages that have got a little bit more, you know, a little bit of razzmatazz, a little bit of edge, a little bit of, not spunk, that's the wrong word, but, you know, like spunk in the old-fashioned way, it's not spunk, like, you know. And they kind of say, like, you know, I don't know, somebody set fire to a, well, no, not set fire to a car, it's not an episode of Shameless, but, you know, did something that's a little bit heftier than where I live.
Yeah.
Gets to where, like, I lived. And it's usually something, one was stalking, which I was like, I don't use that.
That's, yeah.
And they're usually things like member of parish council pestered, something about planning permission. Something without planning permission. It's all the big stuff. And that leads me to a very short story before you just hold on to your thought, because I want to hear it, is that my mum was coming back from parish council meeting. And if you didn't have preconceptions about me already, you're going to have them now. So let me just say, I'm going to tick all the boxes of cliche. Don't worry. Don't think that I sound like this and I'm secretly kind of, you know, like a hardened crim and
She drinks bottles of like special brew on a morning.
Oh yeah, and then I punch the over 80s at bus stops. I don't. I'm exactly as you imagine me to be. And it was like, she is, yeah. My mum came back from parish council meeting and she was driving down this road. I won't say where it is because it's near where I live. But look at me, like I'm going to have such avid fans. They're going to tell my house. You're like, get over yourself, Alex. Anyway, she was driving down this country road. And she heard a bang and she stopped the car. She's like, oh my God. And she thought she'd been shot at. She was on the parish council. And then she realized it's a child's balloon that had got stuck under her chair and popped under the car seat. But when she told us this, I was crying. I was like, why did you think you'd been shot at? She went, Alex, I'm on the parish council. And I was like, again, yeah. And she's like, people want planning permission. I was like, oh, okay. So people are just waiting for the parish council meeting. And they're like, there she goes. There's Elaine in her Volvo. Better fire the gun.
But I love that.
Yeah. And it was like just a balloon from, because we were younger at the time, from my little sister. It popped under the car seat. So anyway, there you go. So
I'm glad your mum wasn't executed like Tupac or something.
Yeah, she wasn't dispatched on the streets of like East Compton or Brompton, whatever. It's not Brompton, that's London. But yeah, I think, you know, a guy with a top hat and a rattle around here, that would be a fearsome prospect. You probably just think it's a farmer who gone nuts.
Yeah.
Rookeries, no. But sorry, yeah, continue.
Yeah. No. So there were some areas in Shropshire that had that reputation. And there's, so for example, in Broseley, there's an area called the Tuckies. It's kind of between Broseley and Jackfield.
Yeah.
And the Tuckies is kind of like so if you've ever been to Bliss Hill, if you haven't, completely disregard me. I know Alex has. You know the squatter's house in Bliss Hill?
Yes.
So a lot of the houses in the Tuckies traditionally were like that, or built a bit bigger, but they were very much squatter's houses that were built by the person that was actually living there.
Mm.
And each Tuckie has its own kind of nickname. So it usually pertains to the job that the person did there. So there's like a cobbler's Tucky, and there's all different ones, but that was meant to be so lawless that the police just refused to go down there. So even when it was in its protest, like the peelers and that kind of thing, that kind of similar era, but in Shropshire, it was seen as just so lawless, the police wouldn't go anywhere near it. And they kind of had their own justice system where if someone had done something wrong, the community dealt with it themselves. And as well as that, Iron Bridge now, and the Iron Bridge Gorge, is absolutely beautiful. I feel very lucky to have grown up so close to it, and a lot of my family's heritage is in the gorge. But the gorge universally was seen as being incredibly lawless, and there is
I can't imagine that.
So and there's some really brutal murders that actually took place during the gorge, in the gorge. But a lot of it was to do with poverty, and I just want to move on to poverty in a minute.
Yeah.
But for example, Jackfield now is stunning little hamlet, but in the Industrial Revolution, it had all the trappings of a seaport. So it was full of brothels, bull baiting, fighting, murders, drinking, alcohol that was made in a bathtub, and it really was a very rough and tumble area.
Yeah.
And that's probably why the devil became associated with Jackfield, but it really did have a reputation in the Victorian times in particular of being an area that if you ended up there, you know, something had gone wrong in your life. You're either born there and it was unfortunate, or something had gone wrong, and that's so hand in hand with the Industrial Revolution. So where I was going with this, why I wanted to bring it up, was I wanted to kind of know a little bit of your thoughts on how much you think the fascination with murder comes from more of a social awareness from, so, you know, writers like Elizabeth Gaskell and Dickens, or Dickens famously called murder the dark and dreadful interest of the Victorian times.
Yeah.
How much do so you Dickens. Think this kind of fascination with murder has to do with a awareness of social issues, awareness of the welfare of the poor, but also kind of a, you know, fascination with the poor and poverty and, you know, in the upper classes, as much as that's an outdated mode of looking at it, is how much of it was linked to an increase in social awareness, and also an increase in knowing that you are not them, if you know what I mean, tied in with the Industrial Revolution.
A separation. I think, I mean, firstly with Dickens, let's look at the fact that he was a court writer.
Yes,
reporter in his early career. So he reported on cases, things like that. Yeah, he definitely dramatised stuff for his books. But you know, it's like Oasis or Blur, Beatles or Rolling Stones. Shakespeare or Dickens, I'm Dickens all the way. I think you could be all of them, but if you get a favourite, I think Dickens, you know, aside from ghosting his wife and kids, which I do not condone.
Yeah, dick move, Dickens.
I know, he's always focusing on ghosts. Stop ghosting your wife and kids, babe. But I think in terms of what he did for raising awareness, particularly with things like Oliver, I think is undeniable. Because when was that, about 1838 or so? It's quite early into, very early into the Victorian era. Yeah, I think that raised awareness. But I think a lot of the time, of course, he was raising awareness of the plight, but amongst what I suppose you might crudely call things like champagne socialists. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, like you're saying, this us and them, just as we do today, and you can look at things like immigration, all these things, and you have a lot of very well-meaning people. And I absolutely, I myself have been there, you know, giving, you know, charitable donations, things like this, but you're separated from the reality of it in a way that people maybe who work in the care system or teaching or things do see the realities of how people live. And I think the thing is, the type of writing that Dickens had, I don't think was going to the masses in the way that we see it, not in the way that because of his, even just how verbose he was and loquacious and his sheer kind of abundance of words and things like that. Dickens was aiming at a type of audience, and he knew what he was doing. And also he was educating these people because they can make donations and things like that. But I think, and Gaskell the same, but look, Hardy as well, to maybe a slightly different degree. And actually you could even argue D.H. Lawrence in a way as well. But, you know, this idea of kind of raising awareness, I think it's still there in the same way. And we do it, and, you know, the BBC do it, and people like that, you know, they kind of get an actor with a working class accent or something, and they're like, right, done my quota. You know, it's, we almost do it in a way that feels patronising. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So we're raising awareness and we're throwing money at the problem, or hiring an actor with a Northern accent and thinking that that's equality, when the vast majority of the actors that people hire are from Central or RADA or are very privileged, you know, and they're like, yes, but we've got, I can't remember his name, Stephen, only because I'm crap with actors' names, that very talented guy that's in Time and various things, you know, and even like Sean Bean, people like that, we're like, oh, we've got an actor with a regional accent. So we've kind of hit our quota, and you're like,
we're done now.
Yeah, you're like, it's not strictly what we're meaning by this, is it? You know, the problem doesn't go away. This fixation with how other people live, I mean, even Robin Hood, you know, when they're, I know, I'm going way back, like robbing the rich to feed the poor, but bollocks, that's a much later invention. He wasn't doing that, he was robbing anyone
for himself, you know.
Yeah, namely. Yeah, exactly. But we sort of love this idea of like what they get up to and how, you know, us with our morals and our education can go in and teach them how to behave, and how, you know, they're all sort of, you know, they're all just shagging each other. They're all stabbing each other and doing these things. And you're like, well, yeah, but actually a lot of the worst abuse was happening in the upper classes. You know, you want to look in the 1940s and looking at Eunice Mitford, that went to a supper, and I'm sorry to say it, she went to a supper whereby they brought some Jewish people up and made them eat grass, and she found it highly amusing, and she was a member of the English aristocracy, so you know, fuck that, frankly. There were some abhorrent things that were going on in the upper echelons, but they just weren't answerable for social reasons. But this fixation with what the poor, in inverted commas, were doing, I think there's a massive moralistic thing here of like, awful, we'll go in there and show them all to behave. But the condemning, the mother, you know, mothers to children that weren't, you know, when they weren't married and things like this, it's abhorrent. It's abhorrent.
Completely. And I think that links to the temperance movement so much. And the temperance movement, don't get me wrong, objectively, that is a very positive thing to do.
It's one of the reasons they had cocoa and things like
because
they said
taking away the alcohol that can be so destructive from working class communities was amazing. And particularly in a lot of my research is in Coalbrook Dale and the Dale, Ironbridge Gorge, they opened a library for the miners, they had a cinema, they had places where you can go and listen to lectures. So objectively, the temperance movement did real positive things for the communities that were blighted by alcohol. And so much of, you know, so much of the crimes, when I was looking at which murder to choose, was alcohol was a common factor. But also, can I wholeheartedly say that the temperance movement didn't have at least an air of let's educate those poor working class people who don't know any better, and almost infantilization? Of course it did. And it can, I think something can have some real positives, like the reduction of alcohol, but it can be done in the wrong way. And I think that is a real feature in the Victorian period, is so much of the reaction against crime and criminal communities or areas that are kind of blighted by crime, it's coming from a very patronising place. you know, we mentioned...
No, there's a lot of them. And often they are well-meaning, aren't they?
Yeah, but still, yeah, you know, yeah. We weren't mentioned Richard Thornton Darby on our workhouse episode. He genuinely really cared. I love the man. But so much of it is about that, like you said, let's re-educate them, let's make them better, honourable citizens, and we'll make them good in the eyes of God. And I think so much of this, even though we've not mentioned murder yet, it all enters the mixing pot and it creates that perfect storm for a murder and the sensationalism of a murder. So it's really interesting to look at the societal factors that contribute to these events, because even the infamous ones like Jack the Ripper, they were a melting pot of all these different things we've spoken about.
Yeah.
And, you know, add things in like itinerant working, homelessness, workhouses, prisons, all of these things that were really impactful societal factors. Mm. When you add them to the pot, they make a situation where murder happens.
Well, you know, it's so interesting you say that. And because the other thing, of course, you know, flipping the Jack the Ripper thing on its head, was, of course, that people said he did more for social reform than people had done rattling tins, collecting coins, because people were made aware of the plight of these women, you know, albeit could have been done in a nicer way. But, you know, there are conspiracy. Jack, you know, leave their kind of, you know, uterine things inside. But I think, you know, that's another thing that's fascinating, actually. So we're obsessed with who Jack the Ripper was. Couldn't give a shit. We're never going to find out. Never going to know.
It's never going to take away. You know, if we knew who that man was, it wouldn't take away from the absolute horrendous things that person did.
Oh, like, hideous. And the other thing, of course, you know, and I always find this, there's a sense of irony in this, I'm sure, somewhere buried skin deep, is that, you know, there's forever, here's looking at you, Daily Mail, there's forever headlines that say things like, whomever has found Jack the Ripper. Have we found Jack the Ripper? The answer to that is absolutely no, you haven't. But they always say, we found Jack the Ripper. You haven't. So, you know, it's always Aaron Kosminski. It's not Aaron, okay? I think we all know this by now. No, nor is it Queen Victoria's grandson. Shut up. Anybody else, you know, they're kind of dragging these people through the muck in terms that not, you know, that might have been in their own way not great. But, you know, like Walter Sickert was the other one, wasn't he? Of course, that they said, you know, but I don't know. I think this idea that these abhorrent crimes should bring the awareness of how people are living is a sad reality, I think, because we are sanitized from it. And we say now, you know, that we consider ourselves an informed age. It's going to be interesting how history looks back at us, because poverty, food banks, things like this, abuse, cruelty, all these things. And, you know, and then meanwhile, Boris and his cohorts are having a party during lockdown. You know, there are people that to him, it makes no odds. I don't think he's thinking about that twice. Now he's probably laughing about it at a dinner party somewhere with his, you know, he's awful and says his wife, but, you know, she's awful by proxy because she married him. But, you know, I think this idea of murder, we haven't actually talked about murder yet, but I don't think to talk about murder you need to talk about someone impaling somebody with a knife or something like that. I think you want to look at the social strata, the background of these things as to what happens, because it is nurture over nature. I don't necessarily I know it can be more complicated than that, but you know, a lot of it is circumstance. It's a whole multitude of things. So I think to understand murder, to address murder, you need to look at the social climate at the time, rather than just going, oh, we cut a womb out. Well, I just like blood. You know, there's got to be a plethora of things going on. Just as, like, even if you look at things like, well, even church carvings, I know this is a bit obscure, but church carvings reflect things like the Age of Plague and things like that. Suddenly they start carving things that are to do with the regeneration of life and stuff like that. You know, we do the same in eras. If there's an era where things, you know, mass exodus into cities and things like that, housing, poor housing, education, poverty, all these things all accumulate to this, to social issues such as we've seen, and then to the press going, look what this lot are up to, look what they've been doing, look what working classes are doing. And of course they consider them a different hierarchy, so the working class would be hardworking. They had what they called the underclasses, and these situations where people are going to find it very difficult to come out of situations like that.
It's demonization, isn't it? And it, totally. It still happens, you know.
Oh, it does,
I can remember, like, I'm, you know, growing up in the early 2000s, it was, oh, hug a hoodie, and, oh, the, you know, the chavs are all bad. And the demonization of the working class and underclasses still endures in my lifetime and to this day. And it's something that, you know, I'm very passionate about challenging, growing up in a similar kind of background to it. And I think when you look at these stories and when you look at the horrendousness of the crime, you've almost, you do a disservice to it if you don't look at the situation that led to it. If you don't look at the societal factors that influenced it, that the combination of drink and poverty and crime and poor insanitary conditions and all of this added to the pot to make that situation when that person took another person's life. And it doesn't excuse it, you know. Murder is seen as universally the worst thing you can do for a reason because it's awful, but so much of the historical murders have a narrative behind them, and it's not just the gut. And I think that's one thing that we were both very eager to not do this episode, is to just go straight into the gory details and not focus on the people, because ultimately every single episode we have done, it has been a human story and a human experience. And when we lose the humanity of the past and we take away the fact that they were just like us trying to, you know, it's all our first time being human, unless we're, you know, Hindu or Buddhist or Sikh. Mm. You know, if you take away that humanity of it, we lose touch of our own humanity, I think. So I think it's been really interesting to hear your thoughts on this and to kind of explore it in a little bit of detail to try and work out what makes a murder. And I know that question is as deep as, you know,
what could possibly be.
But I think we've really touched on some really important threads that certainly contribute to a lot of, you know, the things I've researched and the things that I know you'll have researched as well, because they're important threads.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I think it's, you know, well, I think we can go on to a story about murder. But I think even this idea of like Hogarth and things like that, kind of before the Victorian age, with Gin Lane and these type of series of sketches that you could buy to almost make a kind of like Bayeux tapestry of sketches of like parts of London these people actually lived in. You know, this is what's extraordinary, isn't it? Is, you know, it always is, kind of gives me that vibe of when you get like the private school boys that start dressing like they perceive kind of county lines or drug dealers to dress like. They do it with a sense of irony, like Jesus wept, you know. So I think it's a deeply implanted problem that, you know, if you're not going to get to the bottom of. But I do think it's a massive part of our fascination with murder, because we have immediate ideas of the type of people that have committed these crimes. And as we know, the people are as various as the crimes, in fact.
Definitely.
Without a doubt.
I think that's why as well, our minds, when we both said we wanted to do a murder episode, our minds both instantly went to the Victorian period. And I think the things that we've discussed are the reason why we think of the Victorian over anything else. It's amazing to think that an era that probably in reality had very few more or probably about the same as many other murders. And when you look at like the medieval period, for instance, people were killing each other all the time. Yeah. You know, at one point you could kill somebody because they'd killed somebody in your family, like blood feuds and stuff like that. So it's fascinating that even though we knew about those things, we went straight to the Victorians. And I think it's so evocative, the Victorian period. And I know for a fact we've just scratched the surface of things.
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah.
But I certainly think it would be exciting now to explore a story that
Tell us a story, we need it.
Emphasizes the things we've been discussing. So I wanted to stay in Shropshire. I mean, I know people will be absolutely shocked with me that I'm choosing Shropshire.
Surely not. Yeah.
Me? I don't know anything about it. The story I have chosen, the reasons why I've chosen it will be revealed towards the end, but it was from Shrewsbury in 1874.
Mm-hmm.
So just like I'd mentioned about how places like Coalbrookdale and Jackfield and Broseley had areas that the police just wouldn't go to.
Mm-hmm.
Shrewsbury had those too. So, for example, the place that we're going to is Mardol. And Mardol in Shrewsbury, it's lovely now. I've got some friends who live there.
Mm.
But in the Victorian period, it was squalid. It had really harsh conditions. There was the people crammed together in tiny houses. Very, very unsanitary conditions. And interestingly, there's a little folk tale that developed around the same time in the Victorian period about how the devil was sat on the Stiper stones and he threw a stone at Shrewsbury because he bloody hates Shrewsbury. And the stone landed at the boundary of Mardol. And it said that that is the only place the devil can go to. So he can't actually enter into Shrewsbury, but he can go into Mardol because that's where he threw part of the Stiper stones. So that's his boundary.
That's cool. Yeah.
So the devil's boundary is Mardol. And that's part of the reason why it was so squalid and so kind of awful. It was awful to live there. And I think that's just a little insight into how folklore can mirror the real world. But our two people that we are going to be focusing on is Emma Marsden and Henry Doricott. Mm-hmm. And they shared a room in the King's Head in Mardol. They had very difficult lives. And, you know, I'm going to come across quite negative towards Henry because of his actions and because of what he did. But I want to make it explicit that he had had a very difficult life. He'd had a life of poverty. He'd moved from kind of the Ironbridge Gorge, that kind of area, over to Shrewsbury for a better life, and that hadn't necessarily happened. He had lived with Emma. They weren't married, but they were cohabiting, and they shared this space in the King's Head. So they had had a very tumultuous relationship. They had had very public arguments, lots of disagreements, and genuinely were known to be quite a tumultuous couple. They were that couple that you wished you could just separate.
Yeah.
But we instantly, I know for a fact everyone has got one in their head. But
like
they
that.
Were,
yeah.
They were two that were worse, that were difficult anyway and had difficult lives, but they were terrible for each other. But that was fueled so much by drink. So the more that they drank, the more they would argue, the more they would fall out. And often that argument would get physical with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the premise for the kind of lives they were living. They were both very much out of work. There's a lot of evidence that Emma was actually selling herself. She was prostituting to try and gain a little bit of income. And the event, the murder, happened on the 14th of September 1874. The two had been out drinking, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon they were walking home when they started to have a row. It's not clear what they were arguing about, but it was very noisy, and the neighbors actually told the police. And in these kind of areas that are so blighted by poverty and crime, it must have been a bloody awful row for the neighbours to inform the police, because there was a real distrust of the police. The police was still only in its earliest kind of times, really. So the police were certainly very, the community was certainly concerned, and they called the police. They were arguing. And actually a police constable did go round to investigate, but he didn't want to interfere in a domestic argument. Yeah, so
that was quite commonplace, wasn't it? They wouldn't.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm not. It was very much the idea that it was the man's business, so I'm not going in and helping that poor woman. So he stood outside for a bit and then left. At 3 o'clock, Emma was seen standing outside the house, wiping blood from her face and crying, but she didn't complain to anyone, and she returned to her house after the argument.
Did they have children?
They didn't have children, which is, you know, a genuine blessing, as horrible as it is, you know, that children weren't exposed to this. So it was very clear that regardless of what had happened, Henry had obviously attacked Emma, because she's bleeding. She's crying outside the house. At 4:30, the row was still going on. And a lady known as Amelia Arrowsmith, who was an occupant of another house, went on record to say she could hear raised voices as she left the building. She returned at 10 to 11 Mm-hmm. And but as soon as she got into the house, so quite late into the night, really. Well, it is for me as a teacher.
Me too.
And when she got into the house, she heard screams and shouts, more crying. And then she heard somebody fall down the stairs and Emma's voice crying for help. Emma was helped to bed and she remained there for several days until she died on the 19th of July.
Okay.
She had fallen down the stairs, or at least the way it was put forward at first to the community was that she had fallen down the stairs. It was that, you know, or she'd just taken a fall. She was drunk and she'd fallen. But quickly, it had started to become very apparent that Henry Doricott was part of it, because okay. he was known for being quite violent towards her, and the police got involved. And before we go on to talk about kind of the trial, I just want to really dissect the event a little bit. I know there's not much we can discern from the newspaper reports. All we know is that Emma had very clearly been attacked by Henry, mm-hmm. and he'd done such a terrible kind of attack on her that she'd actually died of her injuries days later. And there is some record on some of the newspaper accounts I've read is that he had pushed her down the stairs and then he'd hit her with an iron rod, which is awful. It's absolutely awful to consider. Yeah. But Emma, and I think it's something I think you'll definitely agree with, that her experiences are so indicative. She could be so symbolic of, unfortunately, a lot of women's experiences in the Victorian times and sadly afterwards, is that this world of poverty and of alcohol and of, you know, the slums, essentially everything that you know of being the slums, has created a situation where this woman has been brutalized and lost her life. And I just think it's very sad, regardless of the events, of this poor woman had her life taken in such a way.
Mm.
But she's so symbolic of the experiences of women in the era, because as we know, you know, women's lives, even things like the Bastardy Clause coming into effect, there was a lot of laws and social events that were created essentially to make women's lives harder. So I just, you know, I'd like to wonder your thoughts on that and how, what you think about the whole thing so far.
I think it's harrowing. But I think it's shocking, but also we are accustomed to hearing these stories. And I think it's, you know, the crimes against women like this are, I mean, commonplace might be the wrong word, but are far from unheard of.
Yeah.
And I understand a lot of the time charges are dropped and things like this, yeah. and, you know, such is the nature of abuse. I think the thought that somebody, well, you know, other people are just getting on with their day and living their lives, the idea that this woman, meanwhile, other people are completely oblivious to it, apart from those nearby that can hear it, which you made a very interesting point of saying, if they are subjected to daily sort of fairly abhorrent behaviour, for them to call the police is pretty revealing of how bad it must be. But the fact that he would kick and beat a woman to death in this way is deeply disturbing, and that while the rest of the world is kind of going on about its business while things like this are going on, I think is one of the bits that always sort of makes your skin crawl.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult because, look, as is always the case, certain cases make the headlines and people are appalled and it's abhorrent, and then there are other things going on that are just as bad, like this, which I would argue is not, you know, coming from Shropshire myself, is not a hugely famous story. I haven't come across it prior to hearing you talk about it, but you could argue that it ought to have been because of how grotesque it is. But what singles one crime from another that some really pick up traction and others don't, and there's lots of complicated things behind that, like social situations, race, things like this. Mm. But this feels pretty abhorrent and disturbing to me, in the fact that it's relatively unknown. And I'd imagine, even if you sort of look probably on the British newspaper archives or something like that, I wouldn't have thought there's pages and pages about this, which may be a sort of social attitude towards women a lack of interest in it. Maybe if she'd come from a different social background, this is conjecture on my part. Maybe she'd come from a different social background. Would there be more interest in it if he'd plucked a woman at random off the street? Same when they talk about Jet the Ripper, they're obsessed that they're sex workers, but in fact it was, you know, a lot of crimes happen to sex workers, not because of sex, but because they're vulnerable, because people can get to them in a way they can't
get to. Vulnerability, isn't it? And
exactly.
That's the case with Emma, isn't it?
Who's she going to go to?
Yeah.
You know, when they drop the charges, or not in this situation, but in others, or, you know, whatever it may be, people, the bits that people overlook because she'd been from a different class or something like that, likely might have been more shocking to us. But those are the very reasons that almost make it more tragic in a way, because this is an outcome that for somebody like that is horrendous and maybe is far more statistically likely.
Yeah.
And it would have been from someone from another walk of life, which I find deeply, deeply tragic. The whole thing is disturbing for the level of violence, how grotesque and gratuitous it is, but also the social problems of it are so deeply tragic and harrowing.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing about it, is that it's awful, and it's difficult to talk about and to present this kind of thing, but it's so important to share this woman's story because she's so symbolic and sadly of a class of women who were subject to this kind of treatment. And not every one of the women that were treated in this way will have ended up dead, but so many of them would have experienced similar treatment and similar lives.
Black and blue all the time, like it's kids watching that. And then I can't remember, I saw somewhere they said, and this is in modern times, by the way, but they spoke to a child and he said at first the violence frightened him. Then he grew used to it. Then he grew to enjoy it. As in thought it was just what you did.
Yeah. That's so true.
It's like, that's heartbreaking, isn't it?
And I think it's not just a Victorian phenomenon, this domestic abuse. Of course it isn't, you know, it still happens in this modern day, but tragic. I mean, I used to work in I've had many lives, many jobs, but I used to work in a care home with the elderly, and so many old ladies would talk about their partner, and one of the first things they would tell you is not how nice he was because he, you know, of his hobbies or his quirks or his personalities. They would say, oh, he's never laid a hand on me. And that is really telling of actually,
like, that would be normal. Yeah.
The normalization of domestic abuse in kind of the 18th, 19th century and before and after, is that this was a very real thing for working class women. And sadly, it still is. And I think this case is shocking on so many levels. And the fact that you can walk down Mardle today, you can walk past the King's Head and not know about it, you know, that memory of that event is still there. It's still something that you can tap into, but you don't know about it. So I'm very passionate about getting this story out and sharing it for Emma, but also for women like her that experienced similar events. And quite often it's something we will go into in the ghost episode, but quite often women who were treated like Emma, who had similar fates to Emma, they end up becoming a ghost, not because of any real tangible evidence of a haunting, but because their story, the only way that their community can remember them is through a ghost story. So it really is a fascinating discussion, but it's sadly a very tragic one. But he was arrested. It was something that became very apparent that Henry Doricott was involved with her death. And on the 21st of September, 1874, they had the magistrate's hearing for the murder. And it was actually took place in the Britannia Hotel. So it took place in another building that I don't think it's called the Britannia now, but it's still in Shrewsbury. And they called a number of witnesses, the first one being James Newton, who was the landlord of the King's Head. And he told the court that he knew the couple well, as they were in the habit of coming into his house with other unfortunates. He said that Emma was often drunk, and in the past he had to turn her out of the house for being disorderly, and that the couple had frequent arguments.
God. The Britannia Hotel is the Shrewsbury Hotel, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I was trying to remember which one it was.
I think it's the Shrewsbury. I'm sure it rings a bell. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
Yeah. And he said that he remembers seeing the pair walking down the King's Head passageway towards the home. And he remembers seeing her standing outside against the wall, crying and wiping her apron with blood. It's really difficult to think about that last moment.
This is it, because we do sort of go, oh, like with True Crime, but they're people. Going into, like, you know, if you cut us, do we not bleed? You know, literally, like, they were people. Like, that's, oh.
And you
sorry,
just
carry on. Yeah,
no,
I hate
you just
it.
Want to give her a hug, don't you? I know it sounds
you
silly.
You go in there and twat him and then say,
yeah. And various other people said that they heard a woman asking to be let out of a room and a man, Doricott, refusing. Some actually were worried for her safety and they got Constable Francis and told him about the argument, but he was the one that remained outside.
Mm.
There was a chap called Newton. That's James Newton, who was the landlord. He was working in the pub, but he could hear Doricott shouting, calling her every name under the sun. And he claimed that he heard him saying, "I will serve you as I did before," which is just chilling.
This is what Bill Sykes talks about with Nancy's, isn't it? That's what he's doing.
Yeah. So that demonstrates that there is evidence of him being violent towards her before. And there's various other people. I mean, the defense try and focus on the technicality of the fact that no one actually saw the violence, so he can't prove he did it when, you know, I know they've got to try and defend the man, but it's a very, very weak defense because it's very evident that he had something to do with this woman's death.
Yeah.
The police constable gives evidence. He says that he actually heard the arguments. And various other people describe the situation. Emilia Arrowsmith gives evidence as well, a woman I mentioned earlier, and she says that she actually noticed that there was no banister rail, which is the metal rod that it was claimed was what actually took her life. Mm. And there's lots more we could really go into, but I don't want to focus too much on the actual trial. Of people who witnessed it that were either too frightened to get involved or too kind of worried about the situation or thought that, particularly the women, thought that if they went, they might make it worse. So they tried to get that police officer. It is mentioned that Doricott, after he had hurt Emma, but before she died, went to a lady called Mary Ann Ledbury's house and asked her for help to torment Emma's chest until the doctor came, so to apply warmth and to bathe it. He followed her back to the room but did not enter, and apparently he was showing to be concerned and anxious about his partner. And she added that he was a violent character and that he was intoxicated many a time and disorderly, though she'd never actually seen the couple fighting, other people had. Eventually, the jury come to the decision that he is guilty. And he says in the record in the newspaper archives, it says one of the only things he says during his trial is, "And you still find me guilty of murder." And they come to the conclusion that he hadn't actually intended to kill her when he was attacking her, but she still died of her injuries. So it was a verdict of manslaughter. And while sentencing Doricott, the judge said that he'd been extremely lenient and human and gave him 15 years penal servitude. But it was only after they sentenced Henry Doricott that they found out that he'd actually had 16 years in prison during his lifetime for violent crime, including felonies, fraud. He'd gone to prison 11 times and he had been a career criminal. Mm. So this whole situation is bloody awful, and I think it really hammers home in the most serious kind of slap to the face possible way that the things that we've been discussing.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was looking at this topic and I was thinking about what murder to choose, there was other ones that I considered, and there was ones that, you know, because sadly murder is a phenomenon that happened fairly often. And there was ones that typified aspects of what we'd spoken to. But I think this one is so harrowing because of so much that we've talked to. And some of the things we've discussed in this episode, we hadn't planned to. It's come organically. And yet this story absolutely demonstrates those conditions that led to the murder. And one of the reasons as well why I wanted to share it is because I actually have a connection to the case. Henry Doricott is my third great uncle. So not a kind of close relative, but I'm actually related to the man. So I think I didn't want to share it to glorify him, but more to bring a light to show how this event that happened within my wider family is so indicative of the situations that were blighting working and you know, people who were living in poverty in the Victorian period. And I just think there's so much we could probably do a whole other episode on the things that come from this story. But I think not in any way to glorify the event that actually happened.
No, I didn't feel like that's what you're doing at all.
Sadness and so much hardship that contributed to that event happening. And I feel for Emma, I really feel for Emma, but I also feel for people that lived around them, that kind of brutality and domestic abuse was so normalized that it could be going on whilst you were doing your washing or, you know, going about your daily business. But for this case, this event on this day, it was so awful that even they felt they had to go and get the police. So yeah, I think it's just such a terrible situation for everyone involved.
Yeah, I think that's, oh God, that's, yeah, it's heartbreaking, awful. And I think, like you say, it's, you always think of these kind of, you know, these crimes happening in places like London and going, oh my God, you know, you can't, but like, yeah, no, this was, I mean, maybe not commonplace is the wrong phrase, but common enough that it was happening in, you know, people's communities or wider communities, certainly. And I think that wouldn't have been the only one happening in that, you know, in Shrewsbury, which is a, you know, in the scheme of things, relatively small town, you know.
Yeah, it is.
And like I say, it's somebody's, when we do all this, and I do it, I get Netflix and I'm like, oh, great, amazing. You know, and we're all guilty of sort of, maybe we do register or not, that these are people's families, and, you know, it's just awful. I mean, you know, quite a note to leave everybody on.
I know to make an entrance, don't I?
I hope you've had a nice time.
I'm related to enjoying yourselves. Awful man.
But I think sort of in a way, I was going to say kudos, but I'm not sure that's the word because it seems sort of bad taste. But I think I really respect you discussing that as well, like making it a kind of, you know, for as a wider subject as well. Because yes, a lot of people would have a story like that and think, oh heck, you know, don't. But it also stands to reason and such is a testimony rather that it's nurture of nature. These are people, you know, who can no more help being related to someone who's done a crime like that than you can control the weather, you know.
Yeah. And I think there's Emmas everywhere. Every town will have an Emma.
Without doubt.
Yeah. And every town, unfortunately, will have a Henry Doricott. And, you know, had Henry's life been different, had he grown up in a more affluent background, would he have been a murderer? Time, you know, we can't tell, but in all likelihood, probably not. Would he
I think we know the answer to that one, don't we? You know, being treated better or whatever it may be. But then it's such a fine line of, you know, are people villains anymore, a complex character? We get so worried about then sort of absolving them of their crimes by acknowledging the problems, and I don't think that's what people are doing.
No.
Say we're acknowledging their backgrounds and problematic characters, we're not absolving of what they've done.
No,
acknowledging the problems that are around it, because if you don't, nothing ever changes, nothing gets improved, nothing gets, you know, progresses. There's no reform.
I think we do a disservice, don't we, to history and to human beings if we try and make out the good or bad, black or white,
you know, agreed.
Light or dark. It's we're innumerable shades of grey. And I think sometimes those shades of grey do become darker and we do end up doing terrible things and things can happen. But equally, there are light, and there is light, and there's so much. We're very dualistic, aren't we, human
beings?
There's
more goodness than bad in the world, I want to say. Yeah.
In the world. And sometimes those bad things happen. And yes, that person has done a terrible thing, but that doesn't mean the whole world is that way. And I think that's what's possibly even the enduring legacy of the murder in the Victorian period, is that people could open their Penny Dreadfuls and they could read these things in the newspaper, and then they could go back to the comfort of their own homes and know, yes, it was happening, and that it happened down the road from you in Mardle when you were up in one of the more affluent parts of Shrewsbury, but you could carry on with your life and it didn't directly affect you, but you could still learn from it or live vicariously through it. I think, you know, it's like so many of our episodes, we don't really come to a conclusion, but we simultaneously come to many conclusions. And I think that's what's happened with this episode, is that can we confidently say what caused the Victorian phenomena of the cult of the criminal? No, but we can tell you quite a lot about it and some of the main threads of it. And I think it's been really fascinating to look at this, because so much of what we're going to be moving on to is linked to murder.
Yeah.
Is linked, like when we do in a few episodes time, our discussion about ghosts, so much of that is linked to this. And I think it really is exciting to talk about, but also very, I suppose, sobering to think about as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of the perfect, albeit, it's sort of, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot, isn't
yeah.
it?
I think, but life's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. Guys, thank you so much for coming this far. And if you've listened to it in a one or in a twos or whatever you've done, thank you. Hope you enjoyed it. We're back in a week or so with another episode. We do usually do fortnightly, just because our episodes are a little bit longer and it gives you more chance to kind of listen to them. But sometimes we might be weekly. Mostly we're probably going to be fortnightly. But, you know, keep your eyes peeled. We're on socials. Amy's also on Instagram now and she's putting some fascinating stuff up. What's your Instagram handle now, Amy?
Instagram is still a very new phenomenon for me. I had it
interesting stuff up though, so don't be fooled.
I first started when I was like in my early 20s, and now I'm scared of everything. It is nearly knowledgeable. So my blog.
Knowledgeable. Yeah. There you go.
But I am old and Instagram scares me.
I'm older than Amy, so that's even worse. Amy put some great stuff up. I'm at Alix, A-L-I-X. _CU. You can see us, Shropshire Witches, as well. And yeah, find us, follow us. I'm on TikTok as well. Look us up, and we do videos and short facts and all sorts. So find us, keep following us, and thank you so much. We'll see you all next time. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
How do I stop recording?